Good afternoon, everyone. This is Pastor David. Got Pastor Joey here in the office with me, July 22nd, about 1:15. And it has been several days. It's probably been several weeks with the Israel-Gaza conflict that's going on over there. And we thought it was about time to take a few moments and comment on it. I got a couple articles here for you. One is from the Christian Post. One is from the Michael Medved Show. That he writes, and I want to look at both of them. But the first article, it's from the perspective of a Palestinian Christian. And I remember we talked about this yesterday. Joe is kind of like, oh, there are Palestinian Christians.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought about it when you said that.
Yeah, I just happen to know someone, an American female, her husband is a Palestinian Christian. And so her post on Facebook actually kind of pushed me to do this because she had said, you know, don't just throw up stuff without thinking about it because, you know, we have people here like me that's a mother of two, you know, Palestinian, Arab, half Palestinian Arab children, you know, and it hurts a little bit when you kind of just throw these stuff up there. So I thought, you know, let's take a look at that. And see what we've got going on, because I think really what we can break this podcast up into is two sides. One is, you know, Israel as with its rights as a nation, and then Israel and its practices and what we can support and what we maybe shouldn't support. I think the blanket evangelical response often is Israel's always right.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that's always the best way to go about things. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying we shouldn't support Israel. You know, as soon as you say that, you'll have people coming out of the woodwork going, oh, don't stand against God's people. Well, I'm not standing against God's people. I think God's people is kind of an interesting term, too. We could really take that apart on current Israel. It's not really a God-fearing place. But I think that's something we can look at. So here's this Palestinian Christian. He says, Western Christians don't understand Gaza-Israeli conflict. And he says, Western Christians fail to fully grasp the suffering of Palestinians, including its Christian population. Bethlehem Bible College professor, Palestinian Christian, told the Christian Post on Monday. The Christians in the West, most of them, they don't know the realities here. They don't know who's occupying who, who's oppressing who, who's confiscating whose land, who's building walls to try and separate people from one another. Alex Awad, who also pastors East Jerusalem Church, told the Christian Post, in the United States and much of Europe, people, they just don't understand the realities on the ground. And so I think the words that you see in there are occupation and oppression. And depending on who you talk to, those things can mean very different things. My other motivation for doing the podcast is I've got a friend that I went to college with that's very pro-Palestine. And so he has a very strong opinion on his social media sites as well. And so I really want to understand where everybody's coming from on this. The article goes on to say, according to Awad, the reality is that the root causes of the Gaza conflict date back further than the kidnapping and murder of three Israeli teenagers. I think we all know that. Instead, he blames Israel for not following through with John Kerry's plan under which the country was required to free Palestinian prisoners, whom he suggested were unfairly imprisoned after protesting the West Bank settlements. Awad believes that its failure to follow through with this condition engaged an already angered and economically deprived Palestinian population. He also called the current fighting a cover-up for the settlements and a diversion to focus attention to Gaza, even as the real crisis took place in the West Bank.
Well, I guess, you know, we're talking about Israel's rights as a nation. Mm. And I guess what Israel does not, as a sovereign nation, have to listen to what John Kerry says.
Right.
And that's where sometimes they're not our puppets, and sometimes mm-hmm. we pretend like that, and where we think that, and that they have to listen to everything we say. And they're a sovereign nation, just like we are a sovereign nation, and we would be offended or frustrated if China said, you have to do this, America. And we would say, no, we don't. And I think that's... So they don't have to do anything as a sovereign nation unless you want to go try to make them do it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think we'll get into that a little bit in the second article. Is what you'll hear a lot is that they are occupying. They have no rightful place there. And I think the second article will give us a lot of insight on that. But from the perspective of these people in Gaza, they view this as an occupying force. They view it as an oppressive force. Now, and I want to say if they have people imprisoned unfairly, if they're treating prisoners, you know, that unfairly, then I don't think we should support that. You know, that's totally different than their existence as a nation.
Yeah.
You know, there are moral issues here, and then there are kind of more political issues. And I think I think those are two very different things. I don't know that you can call the nation of Israel occupiers, but are they occupying places in Gaza and the West Bank unjustly?
Are they respecting boundaries?
Yeah,
that are in
exactly.
Place?
That yeah. are supposed to be there. You know, that's a totally different issue, I think, and I think that's one you can have a decent conversation with. The other side is totally different, and I think they're in a very, I think Israel's in a lose-lose situation. I don't think they can win because if they don't defend themselves, well then
they're toast.
Then what's the point? And then if they do defend themselves, they're going to run into some very negative things in the media. You know, if they bomb Gaza, it's a densely populated area. There could be civilian casualties and things like that. You know, it's a difficult position to be in.
Well, they're in a lose-lose situation. And I guess sometimes the reason I even... we're talking about prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would say, and I, you know, I might get in a little trouble for saying this, but I would venture to say that we're probably holding some people in Guantanamo Bay, and we shouldn't be holding them.
Perhaps.
There are people there that maybe were suspected, and they've never stood trial. So sometimes we get on these other countries, we get on Thailand for a human trafficking, when human trafficking is going on in the United States, and we try to pretend to be the pious Pete's on the world stage, but we have a lot of issues on our own. And so to me, it's even a little hypocritical to start demanding other countries to do things that we ourselves do. We invade other, condemn other countries for invading countries, and then we invade countries.
Yeah.
And to me, it just makes us look as a nation, it makes us look a little silly.
Yeah.
As a whole. And I know that's not necessarily the point of what we're talking about, but to me, there is an underlying issue where we pretend like or want to be the puppet master or the principal of the school that's, you know, instead of just being.
Yeah. And I don't know that we're quite as powerful as we think we are or as we used to be. He says the news media doesn't tell a comprehensive story where the average person will understand the causes and effects. The thing did not happen in a vacuum. What's happening today in Gaza, the Israelis' attack on Hamas's rockets in Israel, it did not happen in a vacuum. The way that the Israelis dealt with the prisoners on one side and also the collapse of the peace process on the other side created that anger that brought us to the position. Okay, so again, there's another situation here because we've got your normal, everyday Palestinians and then we've got your members of Hamas. Well, those are two different entities as well. I think, you know, your normal... And maybe I'm wrong, but I think your normal everyday Palestinian and your normal everyday Israeli, I think they could cross paths, and I don't think they're going to knock down, drag out in the street. But we've got radical elements within Palestine. They have a seat of power. They have weapons. They are obviously firing rockets into Israel. If there were people in Mexico firing rockets into the United States, I would hope that our military would respond. Which maybe some of that stuff's happening right now. Maybe not rockets, but apparently they're shooting at us over there.
Yeah.
But, you know, if those things happened, I would hope that we would respond. And as a nation, doesn't Israel have that right to respond to a terrorist attack? Now, if you want to criticize methods, if you want to criticize the way that people are treated, well, that's a different conversation. But if they have rockets flying at them every day, do they not have the right to defend themselves, to exist as a nation?
And it's an unfortunate part of war, but Israelis are losing children's lives when rockets are coming over.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, sometimes they're pitted as these big bad bullies, but I mean they have a right to defend themselves. That's their whole job as a government is to protect a people.
And I've heard the criticism of you know, you can read about this. Well, Israel has the Iron Dome rocket defense system. Most of those rockets get shot down. I think 99% of them get shot down. And Palestine does not have that. Well, that's kind of an empty argument. It's like, so if a guy comes into my house with a knife and I have a gun, I'm supposed to put the gun down and fight him with the knife. You know, if I have the gun, I'm going to defend my house with the gun, not with the knife. You know, I don't have to go down to his level. So it's kind of a ludicrous sort of thing. Well, they don't have that defense. But if you read about what's been going on is the Israeli Defense Force, they'll set off mortar bombs, small mortar bombs, to warn people that an airstrike is coming. They have a phone system. They drop leaflets in neighborhoods from aircraft to say, you guys need to get out of here and get to a safe place. Now, you know, is that the ideal situation? No, it's, you know, those people have to run or walk someplace, but they're trying. Yeah. They are warning.
Hitler was not doing that.
Not at all.
He was bombing London. Yeah,
most people weren't, and they do have some pretty pinpoint rockets. I saw something today where it talked about they were taking out sites that were right beside schools and hospitals and things like that, which is where Hamas fires from, in order to try to prevent the missiles from coming in. There's some different. There's a lot of facets to this that I don't know that we really take a look at. So I would agree with this professor in that we don't always understand. He says the Palestinian Christians in Gaza today suffer as much as the Palestinian Muslims in Gaza. They are under bombardment. They have only 8 hours of electricity of every 24 hours. They have a hard time getting fresh water. The Palestinian Christians don't live in an isolated area where it's just a Christian town. They live among the Muslims in Gaza, and therefore as much as the Muslims are suffering, the Christians are suffering, not only in the Gaza Strip, but also in the West Bank. And he says Palestinian Christians have not turned violent.
And I think this is where my ears perk up a little bit, mm-hmm. because now all of a sudden, now you're talking about brothers in Christ.
Yeah.
And now we have as Christians, we have a completely different way of trying to look at this.
Yes. So,
these are brothers.
Yeah.
They're in the body of Christ. We'll be with them in heaven one day.
Right.
We have a responsibility to pray for them and love them and maybe try to figure out a way to help them.
Yeah.
And get aid to them if at all possible.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that's not the case with the Israelis. I mean, that's the one thing I want to make sure we get out here is, you know, I have a very healthy respect for Israel. I really do, but that's not the Israel of God. That is not a nation that is following God. I mean, it's as godless as any place in the world. It's very modern. It's very secular. People are very proud of their Jewishness in a cultural sense, but we don't have. We don't have a bunch of Bible believers or even Old Testament believers walking around Israel right now.
There's a small segment of ultra-Orthodox Jews, but that some of them are able to drive this extreme Zionism.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, when we read the Old Testament, we see that Israel, even in the Old Testament, God does not give them a blank check.
Right.
And so I sometimes wonder about why we should give them a blank check. If they're doing things that are inhumane, and would be degrading the image of God in someone, they should be corrected for it. Now, I'm not saying, you know, we invade their nation like happened in the Old Testament in the time of the prophets. That's not what we're saying.
Right.
But what we are saying is you don't get a blank check just because you have Israel. And it would be even hard for us to know how many of those people are ethnically pure Jews, right? I mean, it would be fairly
difficult.
So many centuries removed, 2,000 years removed from the temple being destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
Records being destroyed, it'd be really hard to
trace an accurate lineage. Yeah, and it says here that Gaza's Christian population is about 1,000 people. So I mean, we're talking a pretty small number of people here that are in there. I think the one that jumps out at me is here is Awad said, despite the shared sense of being under the same yoke of oppression that unites him with his fellow Palestinians, his heart goes out to any Muslim, Christian, Jew, Israeli, whatever their title, who may be affected by this unnecessary war. And I think we can agree with that. You know, I hate the fact that people are affected and people are losing their lives in a war that in a lot of cases doesn't involve them. They happen to be occupied by a terrorist group and they're almost caught in the crossfire in a lot of these different cases. And so I would absolutely agree with him in that sense. Now, I think what you get, even among the Christian community, and we could put this in Christian communities all over the world, is a certain amount of anti-Semitism. And I think I can hear a little bit of that here. This guy's obviously not pro-Israel. Now, he says, you know, we want nobody to be affected by the war. That's great. I get that. But his view on Israel is pretty negative here, I think. And I think that comes through in what he's saying, is that all these different groups, he almost allies himself more with the Palestinians because of an ethnic connection rather than a Jewish connection, which would be more of a theological, spiritual sort of connection, I would imagine.
They would be our spiritual forefathers.
Yeah.
We go back to Abraham.
Yeah.
So you're children of Abraham by faith. Yeah, and you really don't want anti-Semitism. You don't want I don't know what we'd call being anti-Arabic would be called. But
yeah, whatever the term. I'm sure there's a term for it. Yeah.
You don't want to be racist toward any one group of people.
Yeah,
but it's hard. I mean, if someone were throwing rockets into our backyard, we would have a hard time loving our neighbor as ourselves. It would be very difficult.
Especially when the conflict dates all the way back to, you know, Isaac and Ishmael. And that's what we're talking about.
Which is a whole other point, which people bring up all the time in this debate, is we have this, I don't know that we're going to fix this.
Right.
I don't know that we,
right.
you and I, John Kerry, Netanyahu, I don't know that we have any ability to fix the issue that's going on there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is a lot bigger than us.
I think the only way the issue gets fixed temporarily is for Israel just to go in and wipe out the whole place.
Yeah.
But then I'm almost sure that they would be attacked by every Islamic nation surrounding them, and that wouldn't be good either. So.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm not saying that you go wipe them all out, by the way. I'm just saying.
and that would probably escalate things in other ways because you wouldn't be getting rockets from that direction. But if you've ever looked at a map, they're kind of surrounded by Arabic nations. Now, Michael Medved wrote a letter. He says it's an open letter on Middle East confusion. And I think he's got some really good points and some really good facts in here. And his first one, he says, if Israel has no right to exist, which is what you'll hear from a lot on the Palestinian side, what is America's right to exist? You know, he says, no one claims that the Brits and others who settled North America were coming back to an ancestral homeland, which is what Israel claims. No international organization ever recognized their right to that homeland, like the League of Nations did in Israel in 1923 and the United Nations did in 1947. No one can possibly claim that Israeli settlement caused a demographic disaster for the native population, since the Palestinian population of the country is more than 50 times greater than it was when Jewish return began in earnest in the 1880s. So that's one point. He'll bring it up later, too, is we're not talking about 1948, 1947. We're talking about 1880s, this reestablishment started. At no time in no decade did Palestinian population decline, but the Native American population drastically declined, mostly through disease, from the beginning of European colonization until 1900, when Indian numbers began a dramatic rise. So, you know, several things he lays out here is, you know, the Americans weren't coming into a land that used to be theirs. It was never theirs. Nobody gave them a right to that. They just came in and kind of took it. And then the Native population suffered for a great deal when they came in. All three of those things are exact opposite for Israel's resettlement of Palestine. Now, what was Palestine when they reestablished Israel? Well, it wasn't a nation unto its own. It was a British colony. Okay, so that's one thing to remember, is Israel did not come in as a conquering force. Even if we just look at the influx of people that came in after the Holocaust, that is a wounded people group coming back in. That is a heavily persecuted, just tried to be wiped off the face of the earth by Adolf Hitler group that's coming back in. So it's hard to call that an occupation, especially when the United Nations and Great Britain are the ones that kind of facilitated that land being given back. So it was not a takeover in that sense. Now, did some things maybe happen that might be categorized as that? Possibly. I know there's some different stories about some different massacres that happened in villages and unfair treatments and things like that. But it was not a conquering armory that marched in to take the promised land back. That's just not what happened. So he poses four questions. Number one, if Palestine was the ancient homeland of an ancient people with their own strong sense of national identity, can anyone name, please, the most famous Palestinians produced in those centuries and millennia of history? Who was the most celebrated of all in a long line of Palestinian kings or viceroys or prime ministers? Which Palestinian poet or philosopher stirred the world with his words and ideas? Which great Palestinian scientist or inventor or composer or painter achieved international or even regional renown? The inability to answer that question doesn't testify to a lack of ability or brilliance. It testifies to the synthetic, phony nature of Palestinian identity. There were no remarkable or brilliant kings of Palestine because there were no kings of Palestine at all. No Arab nation ever existed in this area. Only ill-defined pieces of various Islamic, Turkic, Byzantine, and Roman empires over the course of 2,000 years. The only time any national identity existed centered on this particular piece of real estate, that national identity was Jewish. That's why the only famous Palestinians who ever existed were Jews, from King David to Jesus to Moses, Maimonides. Yeah, he was a rabbi, I know that. He died in Israel in 1215. To David Ben-Gurion, no Palestinian Arab nationalism ever existed as distinct from pan-Arabism until Yasser Arafat, born in Egypt, raised in Kuwait, invented it out of whole cloth after the June War of 1967. And so you'll hear this a lot, is that that Israel has no right here. This is a Palestinian land. Well, I think that's hard to defend if there was no nation there.
Yeah, when you think about the first British prime minister, Benjamin Disraeli was the first Jewish prime minister of Great Britain, and he finished office in 1880. They took over Palestine mid-1915 or something like that. Mm-hmm. So you'd even think that the influx of Jews to that area could even be some connection, openness to allow them to get there.
Yeah.
Because you have a pro-Jewish sentiment in Britain. I mean, you have a prime minister that's Jewish. So this is interesting, because this is not stuff, you don't hear this on CNN.
No.
I don't know that you hear this on Fox News. I don't watch Fox News because I don't have cable.
Yeah.
But I don't know that this is stuff that people are getting, whether it's right-wing or left-wing. And this is just history. You can't really reinterpret this.
Yeah, I think that's the thing is, you know, we've got history. Jewish settlements have history there. They have many, many cities and tells and battles and people and kings and everything else in between with a lot of records of it. No Arab nation ever existed here. So can you, and I mean, think about this area on how it was put together. When Israel wasn't there, who populated this area? Was it an indigenous people group, or was it other groups that were either came in as invaders or were brought there as slaves and exiles? I mean, when the Assyrians come in, they repopulate this area with their people and people that they've conquered. When the Babylonians come in, they repopulate the area with people that came back in. So you've got quite a mixture of people going on here. So I think, you know, what we think we talk about is the apologetic of the existence of Israel. You know, the Israel still exists, and we still have distinct, you know, we talked about how it's difficult to trace genealogies, but we've got a definite Jewish state here. And the question would be, have you ever met a Hittite? You know, did you ever run into an Amalekite? Did you ever run into an Amorite? No, you don't know those people because those people have passed out of existence. They weren't a state. They were a group. They were a clan. They were a group of people. And people can't really trace that anymore. And yet we've still got Israelites to this day that live in Israel. I think
that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it really is. It's a good apologetic, I think, for eschatology.
Well, especially when you consider the fact the persecution that they've gone under in the 21st century in Russia. What did they call it? But they had the cleansing in Russia to get rid of Jews, and that's a reason why some of them start to try to get back to the homeland.
Yeah, and I mean, all you have to do is, and it's not just this area. Yeah, like you said, Russia, Germany. You've got in Rome, in many cases, that the Jews were expelled from cities, and you know, different time periods. So, considering everybody in the world, you know, all these different nations have tried to eliminate them, including all their immediate neighbors, and yet they're still there. There's some, maybe something to be said there. Number two, if Palestinians merely yearned to establish their own homeland on the West Bank, Gaza, and in East Jerusalem, why did they make no effort to do so and no progress in doing so during the 20 years when all those territories were in unquestioned Arab control, 1947 to 67, without a single Jewish settler or even resident allowed to live there? This is pretty interesting, I think, and I didn't know this till I read this. The ancient Jewish quarter of the Old City of Jerusalem, inhabited by a religious Jewish community without interruption for more than 3,000 years, had been liquidated of all Jews, with more than 50 major synagogues utterly destroyed by explosions and bulldozers after the Old City fell to Jordanian troops in 1949. Before the war of extermination launched by Nasser in May 1967, there were zero Israeli communities anywhere in Palestinian territory, but no moves toward statehood. Isn't this definitive proof that the whole purpose of Palestinian nationalism has nothing to do with building a Palestinian state, where one never ever existed, but in destroying a Jewish state, which did exist in the region for more than 1,000 years? So if you don't know your history, Israel is established in 1948, and at that point, Great Britain basically takes hands off. They allow Israel to exist, and as soon as Great Britain moves out and takes hands off, all surrounding nations attacked Israel. Egypt, Syria, Jordan, all these different places start attacking Israel. And little tiny Israel fought it out and survived. Again, you know, maybe some sovereignty going on here. It happens again in 67, where all the surrounding nations attack them, and Israel wins wars fairly easily when they are majorly outnumbered.
6 days, right?
Yeah, those kinds of that kind of quickness.
Yeah.
And so why? I think that's a great question. There were, for 20 years, there were places where Jews were not allowed to enter that were in full, maybe say, Arab or Palestinian control, and no effort was ever made to establish a state. I would think if it was all about my nation and my statehood, and I felt threatened by those Jews coming in, I would make sure that my state lines were drawn, and yet no effort is ever made in that direction.
So this seems to be more about anti-Semitism maybe than it does about establishing a homeland.
I think so, yeah. I think we can, the cover might be that they deserve a Palestinian state, but I think more of it is, it's almost like, I don't care if we get a state, but they can't have a state.
Yeah.
You know, it's that mindset. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Number three, Zionism and Jewish return to that ancient homeland began in the 1880s. Again, something I wasn't really familiar with. Before Hitler even came to power, a 500,000 Jews had settled permanently in today's Israel, built whole new cities where none ever previously existed. Israel's largest city, Tel Aviv, was founded in 1909 on empty sand dunes, purchased from their absentee owners, and today the metro area is home to 4 million Jews and more than 42% of Israel's population. That's a pretty amazing thing.
Yeah.
1909, it was sand dunes. 2014, it's 4 million Jews and 42% of the population. So the question, during all this energetic and faithful Jewish resettlement, when did the very first Palestinian refugees lose their homes and find themselves driven from their ancient patrimony? Answer, only after 1948 and the war of destruction launched by local Arabs and ultimately their Egyptian, Syrian, Jordanian, Lebanese, and Iraqi allies in 48 and 49. The population figures are unequivocal, undeniable, compiled not by Jews and Zionists, but by Ottoman Turks, Brits, and Palestinian Arabs themselves. Jewish settlement didn't drive Palestinians from the land, but rather attracted them to it in unprecedented numbers. In fact, Palestinian population not only increased alongside the Jewish population, but increased at faster rates between World War I and World War II. The Jewish population went up by 470,000, but the Palestinian Arab population went up by 588,000. Palestinian life expectancy, living standards, and education levels also improved spectacularly as measured by all international and Arab organizations. Pretty strong.
Yeah. It's a pretty good argument.
So the argument is, just to restate it, when did Palestinians lose some of their settlements? After they attacked Israel. And so, you know, do you want to crack down on Israel for a retribution? Okay, maybe you can go with that, but in a war situation, I'm not sure I would let my enemies live next door to me either. If I have a chance to secure that land, I would probably do the exact same thing. So again, the whole conquering idea kind of goes out the window when, as soon as that land was settled by the United Nations, Great Britain, it's attacked from the outside, and that's when certain Palestinians were pushed out.
Think about the number from 1909 to now, 4 million people. Now, what I think is interesting, we go back to skeptics in the Bible to talk about how did the Israelite nation grow so fast?
Yeah.
Well, apparently they like to have kids. Okay, because this isn't all people moving into Tel Aviv, I guess.
In, yeah.
So a population can increase quite quickly.
Yeah.
You know, and I was talking about this with my cousin yesterday. He and I have been talking about it.
Yeah.
And I said, well, let's say Israel gives it all back. Let's say they give them everything they want.
Yeah.
Is Hamas really going to stop firing rockets into Israel? Are they really going to leave them alone?
Yeah, I was watching something last night, and the idea was if Israel laid down their weapons today and said, we're not going to fight anymore, they would be wiped off the map.
Mm-hmm.
If Hamas laid down their weapons and said, we're not going to fight anymore, most of the fighting would stop.
It would be over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, your Palestinian side is going to say, yeah, but they run this thing like a police state. They would still oppress us. They would say, well, that's a separate issue. You know, I think that's something, that's the thing that I'm not going to just blanket up and say, okay, I support Israel and everything that they do. If they are running things like a police state and they are oppressing people, well, that's a whole separate issue. But being able to defend themselves when rockets come flying in, I can't say that that's even a debatable thing, because we would never allow that to happen in this country. And to say that Israel should not defend themselves is quite ridiculous.
Yeah.
If you're against bloodshed, that's quite ridiculous. Number four, if Israel is truly an alien presence imposed on the region by the imperialist colonialist designs of the United States and its Western allies, due to the overwhelming power of conspiring Zionists and Jewish voters, Then how many American troops have lost their lives or even risked their lives on Israel's behalf in the 65 years of the nation's history? Answer, absolutely zero. In none of Israel's wars did American military forces take an active role. In fact, in Israel's War of Independence, 48-49, while the young nation lost more than 1% of its total population on the battlefield, the equivalent of 3.1 million Americans today, the Israel Defense Forces were crippled by a thorough American arms embargo that prevented any material or military assistance to the Jewish state. Arab oil interests have always been more influential in shaping Western policy than Zionist pressure or pleas. So the war that Israel won their independence, not only did the United States not aid them, they didn't give them anything. Yeah. They had an embargo on arms going in. So they won that independence completely absent from the United States jumping in.
Well, even in going back to 1982, I was talking to you about this a little bit yesterday, mm-hmm. When I think Israel and Palestine were going at it, and the United States sanctions Israel.
Yeah.
In part, mostly because of oil. They were concerned about oil production.
Yeah.
And Ron Paul said back then, he was a young congressman, he said, leave Israel alone. He's often called an anti-Semitic. They would, they wouldn't let him speak at the Jewish Republican presidential debate back in 2012.
Yeah.
But he said, leave Israel alone. They can do what they want to do.
Yeah.
So we really, it's been a pretty recent development, maybe the last 20 years.
Yeah.
Maybe a resurgence of the moral majority. That we have this connection with American politics in Israel. We send a lot of money over there recently.
Yes.
But not having lost any lives or fought on their behalf.
Yeah, and we can't say that about many other Middle Eastern nations.
No.
We've been involved in quite a few of them. And I think the interesting thing here is, do you know the only major Middle Eastern nation that does not have oil? It's Israel.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, that's one thing when you can say, well, we're just chasing oil. Well, that's not the case with Israel, because that's not it. And I think the political thing is something he mentions here in a little bit that's really interesting when we get down here a little bit farther. During all the years of Hitler's Holocaust and the 3 years immediately following the war, the British government did nothing to help Jewish refugees who tried to flee to Israel and, in fact, banned their immigration entirely, arresting and deporting any Jews who attempted to enter the area of Mandatory Palestine, today's Israel, Palestinian territories, and Jordan. As recently as 1967, when Egypt's dictator Nasser repeatedly announced his intention to eliminate the Jewish presence in the region and ordered the UN peacekeeping troops to get out of his way, they immediately complied. The U.S. Secretary of State Dean Rusk announced to the world that America would remain neutral in thought, word, and deed and would do nothing to rescue the threatened Jewish population. There's probably a parallel here with Ahmadinejad in Iran, mm-hmm. who has said similar things, and we haven't done anything in that sense either. We've actually told Israel to back off, I think, mm-hmm. more than anything else. Major U.S. foreign aid to Israel didn't begin until after the October War of 73 as part of an effort by the Nixon and Carter administrations to bribe the Israelis, basically, to return the Sinai Peninsula to Egypt, which has a lot of oil in it, by the way. Part of the peace agreement brokered by Carter involved promises of aid at its current levels to both Egypt and Israel. In 67, Israel won its war against Egypt, Syria, and Jordan without any American planes in its air force. The nation relied on French Mirages it had purchased to confront the advanced Russian MiGs used by the other side. So when did we start giving them aid? When we wanted them to give the oil fields back to Egypt.
And we were giving aid to Egypt, too.
As well.
Both of them.
Yeah, which we just did as well, even though they had the Muslim Brotherhood.
And I wonder how many of our tanks, airplanes, and missiles that we've supplied to Middle Eastern countries mm-hmm. to try to help fight Russia then possibly have been used against Israel. Because this is the way it always works for us.
Yeah.
We help them out, and then they turn on
us. That's good for a while.
Yeah, and then they start using our own weapons against us.
Yeah, see the Taliban.
Yeah.
Finally, and this is interesting, I think this is something people need to consider, because what's the blanket statement? Well, you right-wing Christians, you just love Israel, and so you always support Israel. Well, okay, well, let's look at this. If pro-Israel policies are the result of Jewish influence rather than American self-interest, then why do Jewish voters remain unshakably committed to the Democratic Party, which has been constantly less supportive of Israel's interests than the Republicans? The most pro-Israel political figures in American history, Mr. Republican Bob Taft, Barry Goldwater, Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush, never attracted a majority of Jewish votes. But the most anti-Israel nominees, George McGovern and Jimmy Carter, unfailingly performed well in the Jewish community as long as they were Democrats. Since FDR, only one Democrat failed to win more than 60% of the Jewish vote, Jimmy Carter in 1980, who saw the Jewish vote split three ways and nearly evenly between himself, liberal independent candidate John Anderson, and Reagan. In 2012, Romney, a personal friend of Netanyahu's for 30 years, was clearly unabashedly more pro-Israel than Obama, who had feuded publicly and bitterly with the Israeli government. But Obama still drew 70% of the Jewish vote.
And listen to this. In 2000, Bush, depending on your survey or whatever, your exit polls, 70 to 78% of Muslims voted for George W. Bush in 2000. So what does that say? Because he was pro-business, and he was preaching a non-interventionist foreign policy because we were tired of all the intervention that Clinton had been doing in his 8 years in office. So Bush came in with this different kind of conservatism.
Yep.
Let's back off. Let's rein things in. And then 9/11 happened, and none of that came to fruition.
Right.
But the Muslims voted for Bush 70 to 78%, depending on what you read, in 2000.
That's pretty interesting.
Not very pro-Jew, is it?
Yeah, and I would say Obama is, you know, they said, you know, McGovern and Carter are the two most anti-Israel candidates. Well, that Obama blows them out of the water. He is easily the most anti-Israel president we've had. Just look at the way he's treated Netanyahu and different diplomatic situations and how he's treated some of the Muslim countries with much more respect. And that doesn't even mean who we agree with. That doesn't even come into contact there, but you can tell that his alliances, you know, I'm not one of these guys that sits up here and says that that Obama's a Muslim, but he certainly has some sympathies in those areas. He certainly has what seems to be some leanings in those areas. I think I've said before that for the first time in our history, I think if something really came to pass where Israel was being bombarded and attacked, for the first time in a long time, I think we would stand on the sidelines. Mm-hmm. We would not go and help who supposedly our ally.
Well, when 72% of Muslims approve of President Obama's job that he's doing in office, mm-hmm. and the highest percent of other groups is 55%. But interestingly, Jews, 54% of atheists and 44% of Catholics approve of the president's job.
Yeah.
72% of Muslims. So he is the most, can we say, the most pro-Muslim president ever?
And I think it's really interesting because his policies aren't exactly Muslim-friendly sometimes. You know, this whole, you know, evolution on gay marriage, that doesn't really jive with a Muslim mindset. And yet, could it be that they like the fact that he is, it's truly a foreign policy perspective.
Yeah.
They like the way he views his foreign policy when it comes to Muslims.
Well, because extreme Muslims hate Obama. The Boko Haram guy, I mean, you hear him say things, he wants to go after Obama, and that's an extreme Muslim. So they don't look at Obama as an ally over there. They don't like him. But here, they like him because he's more pro-Muslim than he is pro-Jew.
Yeah. So again, I think the myth he's trying to get across there as well, you know, you conservative guys, that you just go with whatever Israel says. Well, there aren't too many of these Jewish voters that are showing up at the RNC. Mm-hmm. That just doesn't seem to be the case. As to the belief that a more pro-Palestinian policy on the part of the U.S. would lead to reduced terrorism against American targets, consider that the worst, bloodiest terrorist outrages in U.S. history all were launched and planned under the most pro-Palestinian administration in U.S. history. Bill Clinton not only presided over the Oslo Accords, which was, kind of some sanctions against Israel to give land back to the Palestinians, granting recognition to the Palestinian Authority, but met more frequently with Yasser Arafat than he did with any foreign leader. He was the head of the PLO. You probably know him. Yet under Clinton, Islamist terrorists plotted the first and second World Trade Center bombings. Yes, 9/11 was entirely planned and set up during Clinton. The embassy bombings in East Africa, Khobar Towers, the USS Cole, and so forth. Under that pro-Palestinian U.S. regime and the similarly pro-Palestinian Israeli regime of peacemakers, Rabin and Peres, Israeli deaths at the hands of terrorists averaged nearly 200 per year. Under the get-tough policies of Ariel Sharon, Ehud Olmert, and Netanyahu, those deaths have averaged less than 20 a year. So there's something, that, you know, the guy in our first article, Palestinian Christians and Palestinians who are not radical Muslims. Okay, I get where you're coming from, and I And I hurt for the stuff that's going on, the bombardments and the shortages and all that kind of stuff. But the fact is, there are people in Palestine whose sole goal in life is to kill Jews. More so than, you know, we are a Satan as well in their mind, but nothing would trump killing a Jew. I mean, they have scriptures in the Quran about killing Jews specifically. So, you know, I think that's when you try to negotiate with those people, which is what he's saying that Clinton did, pro-Palestinian, over 200 deaths a year. When these guys like Sharon and Olmert and Netanyahu will not negotiate with them, deaths are less than 20 a year. So 1/10 of the deaths when you don't negotiate with them compared to when you negotiate with them. These are not reasonable people.
Well, it's just like the gun debate. Mm-hmm. You want to bring down crime. People with more guns in their homes are going to be less. If you know somebody has a gun in their house, yeah, you're going to be less likely to rob them.
Right.
And it's the same thing. We're not going to mess with these guys because we know if we mess with them, they're going to fight back, and it's not going to end well.
Yeah. And none of us live that way. You know, do we want peace? Yeah. Do we want people to die? No. But if somebody was trying to attack you and your family, you wouldn't just lay down. You would defend yourself. Yeah. You know, and our cities would do the same thing, and our states would do the same thing, and our country would do the same thing. So. To put these ideological, you know, utopian sort of ideas onto Israel and say, well, you just shouldn't do that. They're not dealing with rational people. And this is not, again, I think that the thing here is this is not a war against Palestine. It's a war against Hamas. That's who they're going after. Now, the unfortunate thing is Hamas uses Palestine as the shield. And there are Palestinian Christians and there are Arabs there that are not radical Muslims that are now caught in the crossfire because... You know, and I don't know how responsible they are. I don't know how much support they have behind Hamas, but Hamas has a foot in power there, and that's an issue.
And they're clearly not doing a whole lot to try to root them out. Yeah. That's a lot of the situation with Pakistan.
Yeah.
With terrorists living in the mountains on the border of Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Well, what is Pakistan doing to get rid of? Doesn't seem like a whole lot.
Yeah.
Now, they openly condemn things. Yeah. But there's money somewhere coming in. Yeah. There's money that's exchanging hands.
And I get it, you know, because I've got some Arabic friends, and I get it that they, you know, these your average Arab American doesn't like radical Muslims. They don't support them. They don't like the fact that there are suicide bombers and 9/11 and all that kind of stuff. And it's not necessarily their responsibility to speak up. I mean, that doesn't really necessarily mean anything. But the governments, the people that are in power, we don't see anything happening from that perspective. And I guess the one thing you could say about a place like Gaza is it's not a state. You know, it doesn't have a president. It doesn't have a prime minister or anything. And so there is a vacuum there, like the first guy was talking about. And Hamas has filled that vacuum. But where are the other Muslim nations that surround this place that are supposedly, you know, interested in negotiations, democracy? You know, are you telling me if Egypt and Jordan and Syria and Iraq and whoever got involved and wanted to cleanse Gaza from Hamas from Gaza, they couldn't do that in a second? And yet you don't see that kind of stuff going on.
Well, when you have the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt overthrowing the pro-American, what's his name? Safari or something like that, I don't remember. But he was pro-American. We set him up, and then we fund the Brotherhood to overthrow them. So you think they're going to come in and they're going to help with reasonable... Do you think Syria, you think Iran, they're going to have reasonable negotiations with Israel and Hamas to get them out of the Gaza Strip?
Yeah.
It's like the old idea. How well do liberals fight in a war and take up arms and fight in a war? Well, no one knows because they don't fight.
Yeah.
You know, so they're not putting their money where their mouth is. Right. If we were attacked right now, they would want people to stand up and fight. Mm-hmm. They would have, if there are people coming into our country, invading us, killing their wives and their kids, robbing them, pillaging them, raping them, kidnapping their children, they wouldn't be having sit-ins.
Yeah.
They would want to fight.
Yeah.
So it's really an idealistic policy that has, like you said, you can't live that way. It sounds good. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it's great on paper.
It all makes us have warm and fuzzies, but at the end of the day, it doesn't accomplish any goals. And no nation has ever survived without fighting. You have to fight.
Yeah.
It's just the way it is. Yeah, it's not an American thing, like we saw in the D'Souza movie. It's not an American thing.
Right.
It's what you have to do, and it's what God commands a nation to do, is to protect its people from evil. And that's really, at the end of the day, what Israel is trying to do.
Yeah, and I think that, and if we want to come at it from a give you a little bit of theology here at the very end, is I think the failure here, and it's why our founding fathers, and you know, argue as much as you want about how many of those guys were Bible believing Christians, but the one thing that those guys understood and why they crafted the Constitution like they did is they understood that man was fallen. They understood that man was a sinful creature. And all these new ideas is that, you know, we're all basically good people. If I put my on my weapons, he'll put down his weapons. No, he's a sinner, you're a sinner, and he's going to come in and take you out when you put your weapons down, and now you're going to have to go get revenge on him. This whole, oh, we're basically good people and we'll all just get along. It's not biblical and it's not logical. It's just not realistic.
We tried that approach in the 20th century.
Yeah.
Right? We tried it with Hitler, and it didn't work.
Yeah.
He just kept drawing the line, and he just kept crossing the line. Fools!
Yeah.
And he just kept crossing. And next thing you know, he's bombing London.
Yeah.
And he
saw that, well, we did the same thing with Japan in World War I, and we just said, don't take any more islands. And Japan just kept taking and taking and taking and after World War I in the 20s. And Hitler saw that and said, okay, yeah, I can keep pushing it.
He also saw how no one helped the Armenians, Armenian conflict. They were being severely persecuted, and no one did anything to help the Armenians. And so he said, well, they didn't do it. They didn't help the Armenians, so they're not going to help the Jews.
Yeah. Yeah. If you never discipline your kids, they'll tend to do the same thing. You'll find out a lot about sin nature as soon as that happens. So I think, our two issues here are, one, Israel as a nation and its right to exist. It absolutely has a right to exist. It was not a conquering nation. It was a resettlement by the United Nations and Great Britain. They have a right to defend themselves. They don't have to lay down and take rockets flying into their borders. Number two, if there are people in Israel that are performing human rights violations, if they are assaulting, imprisoning, murdering people that are not doing anything, then we can't support that. And so I'm all for cracking down on Israel if injustices like that are going on. Okay, but to say that this whole conflict is wrong, I don't know you can go that route, because they have a right to defend themselves, and you would want the same right. And like we said, nobody lives that way. Nobody lives in that utopian world where people lay down their weapons and pretty music starts playing in the background. So do we support Israel? I think absolutely. Do we support Israel just because they're Israel? No. Again, I think God has plans for Israel. I think there are big things coming in Israel, but this is not that Israel necessarily. And I don't think we just give them a blank check on their behavior. Any final thoughts on that? No? All right, I guess we covered it. So if you have any comments, if you think we're dead wrong, if you think we're being too hard on Israel, or if we're not being hard enough, or we're not taking something in consideration, let us know. Put a comment directly on this podcast. But keep up on this. It is important. It is something that's going to be on the news there for a while. Hopefully this ceasefire will take place very soon. And thanks for listening. Have a great day.